It's December 1969, and above Seattle, Boeing test pilot Ralph Coakley is at the controls of a plane many thought would never fly. That plane is the 747 Jumbo Jet, and it's the biggest passenger aircraft ever made. Coakley radios the airport's control tower.
Renton Tower, November 732, Papa Alpha, on approach, requesting permission to land at runway 15.
November 732, Papa Alpha, Renton Tower, you're cleared to land on runway 15.
Renton Tower, November 732, Papa Alpha.
The 747 weighs 170 tons and can carry more than 400 people from L.A. to London nonstop. Some said it was way too heavy to get airborne, but now it's just weeks away from entering service with Pan Am. Coakley swings the 747 over Lake Washington. Through the rain running along the windshield, he can see the lights of Renton Airport below. On the ground, Boeing mechanics are waiting. When Coakley lands, they're going to strip out the test equipment, install the interior, and deliver the finished aircraft to Pan Am. Coakley starts the descent. He's conscious that Renton's runway is too short and that no one's landed a 747 there before, so he goes in low. Too low. The right wing's landing gear slams into an embankment 20 feet shy of the runway and buckles. The 747 belly flops onto the tarmac and skids down the wet runway. Metal grates on asphalt. Sparks spray from the engines. In the cockpit, Coakley battles to keep the aircraft on the runway using the remaining landing gears. Eventually, finally, the jumbo grinds to a halt. Coakley slumps in his chair and turns to his co-pilot.
Well, been nice working with you. Doubt I'll have a job tomorrow.
Coakley's not wrong. His career at Boeing is over, and that's because a damaged 747 is the last thing the company needs. The company sunk nearly $800 million into making the 747, and its lenders are freaking out. They're convinced Boeing will never repay its debts. Pan Am's unhappy, too. It's threatening to withhold final payments worth millions because the 747's range is shorter than promised. And Boeing's still waiting for the Federal Aviation Administration to certify the 747 as fit to fly. Boeing's bet the house on its jumbo jet. And right now, it looks like the 747's pushed Boeing to the edge of ruin. Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. On the last episode, Boeing broke into the commercial aircraft business big time and pushed its European rivals to the sidelines. But Europe's about to strike back. The French and West German governments are funding the creation of a jet they hope will challenge the American giants. They call it the Airbus. This is episode 2, Cleared for Takeoff.
It's the evening of January 21st, 1970, and history is about to be made at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York City. More than 350 people are boarding the first 747 passenger flight, and they can't believe their eyes. The 747's so huge, it makes every other jet they've ever seen before look tiny. One bouffant-haired woman in a fur coat turns to her husband as she climbs up the ramp. "Earl, it's so big. Probably makes its own weather." The interior's impressive, too. Crimson carpet covers the floor. A curved staircase leads to the first class section on the upper deck, and smiling Pan Am attendants in blue uniforms welcome passengers on board. In the coach cabin, the fur-coated woman finds rows of alternating red and blue seats, and a luxury she's never seen on a plane before. Overhead bins. "Earl, look! They've even got proper lockers for our coats instead of those open shelves." After putting her fur coat in the overhead bin, she settles into her comfy seat and lights a cigarette. Next stop, London. At 7:29 p.m., the first ever 747 flight begins. But it doesn't get far. Just moments after leaving the gate, an engine overheats, forcing the plane to abort its takeoff. A Boeing executive watches from the ground as the plane sulks back to the gate.
"Knew it was too good to be true."
Luckily, Pan Am's got its second 747 on hand. 6 hours later, the passengers are finally airborne. But Boeing can't savor the moment. It's too busy fighting for survival. It's a Monday morning in late 1970, and in Seattle, Boeing CEO Thornton Wilson's heading north on the I-5 in his Chevrolet. He reaches the exit for Boeing headquarters and cringes. The billboard's still there. The sign put up by an angry realtor that's been taunting him for weeks. It reads, "Will the last person leaving Seattle please put out the lights?" The 49-year-old Boeing boss knows it's aimed at him. Over the past 12 months, he's cut Boeing to the bone to fend off its creditors. He's laid off 50,000 people, and more job losses are coming. And since Boeing employs 1 in 5 people in Seattle, the whole city's suffering. Unemployment hits 12%. Boeing expected the 747 to be its greatest triumph yet. Instead, it's an albatross around its neck. When work on the 747 began in 1966, demand for air travel was soaring. But now, the country's in recession, and people just aren't flying as much. Airlines don't want Boeing's giant jet. In fact, they don't want jets at all. Boeing hasn't sold a single aircraft in the U.S. all year. But while Boeing hunkers down, across the Atlantic, a new rival is taking its first steps. It's December 1970, and in a small bare office in Paris, Airbus Chief Operating Officer Roger Bataille pops open the champagne. Bataille pours the fizz and hands out the glasses before raising his own.
"To Airbus industry and the adventure ahead."
The Airbus team lock eyes and clink their glasses. They've got a reason to celebrate. Today, after years of talk, Airbus industry was officially born. But Airbus isn't a company in the usual sense. It's really a brand name for a group of European aircraft manufacturers. It doesn't own any factories and employs fewer than 10 people. Airbus industry's job is to coordinate the production and sale of the Airbus A300 jets. But getting the French, German, Spanish, Dutch, and British manufacturers behind Airbus to work together isn't easy. They speak different languages, use different currencies, and have distinct cultures. They don't even agree on whether to measure in centimeters or inches. These manufacturers don't trust each other either. Away from Airbus, they're competitors. And so they won't tell Airbus the real cost of the aircraft parts they're making. All they will say is how much they want to be paid for their contribution. Airbus doesn't even know how much it really costs to make an A300. But the biggest challenge of all is getting the prefabricated airplane parts being built across Western Europe to the final assembly plant in the French city of Toulouse. It's summer 1971, and outside Toulouse, there's chaos. The traffic's backed up for miles. Frustrated motorists beep the horns of their Renaults as a 100-foot-long flatbed truck slowly carries a giant section of fuselage down a rural road. This piece of fuselage is racking up the miles. It was built in Bremen, West Germany, and then taken by ferry to the French port of Bordeaux. At Bordeaux, it was put on a barge that traveled up the Garonne River until the water got too shallow. Now, it's doing the final leg of its epic journey to Toulouse by truck. To clear the way, French authorities have cut back overhanging trees, raised power lines higher, and blocked the streets. The parts are getting through, but getting them to the assembly plant is agonizingly slow. Airbus desperately needs a quicker solution. It's late summer 1971, and in Santa Barbara, California, Airbus production chief Felix Kratt stares at the strangest aircraft he's ever seen. And he thinks it just might be what Airbus needs. It's called the Super Guppy, and it looks like an enormous swollen metal fish. It's nicknamed the Frankenplane because it's hacked together from the remains of other aircraft, including old Boeing cargo planes. The salesman standing next to the German engineer knows the Super Guppy won't win prizes for beauty, but he also knows its monstrous looks mask its best feature. It's built out of old Boeing's C-97 military freighters and powered by four turboprop engines. I think it's exactly what you guys need. The hull diameter is 25 feet. Yeah, let me show you. Kratt swings open the Super Guppy's nose like a giant doorway to reveal the plane's cavernous interior. Kratt smiles. It's plenty big enough to swallow entire A-300 fuselages and wings. This is perfect. I want two. In November 1971, the Airbus Super Guppies enter service. They buzz around Western Europe collecting and depositing aircraft parts like bumblebees carrying pollen. Transport challenges finally solved. The Airbus A-300 comes together fast. It's September 1972, and the A-300 is about to be unveiled at Toulouse-Blagnac Airport. Airbus pilot Bernard Ziegler carefully steers the prototype jet to the terminal. Inside, a crowd of excited aviation fans are waiting. But Airbus doesn't have this showcase of French aviation to itself. There's a gatecrasher, the latest prototype of France's other big jet project, the supersonic Concorde. And it's about to steal the show. In the cockpit, Ziegler watches the crowd exit the terminal and rush over to the arrow-shaped Concorde. No one looks twice at the plain and functional A-300. Deflated, Ziegler exits the aircraft and heads down the ramp. At the bottom, a friend's waiting. The friend glances at the crowd around the Concorde and then back at Ziegler and the A-300. Oh dear, Bernard, what are we going to do with this big fat cow of yours? Ziegler waves his hand dismissively. Concorde's a political vanity project. It's what airlines think that matters. But the airlines aren't interested in the A-300 either. Even Europe's state-owned carriers that were supposed to buy it. Lufthansa orders the bare minimum. Spain's Iberia cancels its order at the first opportunity. Only Air France seems genuinely keen. So the Airbus team takes the A-300 on tour. They crisscross the globe, hawking the world's first wide-bodied twin jet. But airlines don't want to gamble on a new jet from an untested company that relies on government support to survive. And even when there's interest, Boeing soon swoops in to snatch the deal. It's 1975, and in his Paris apartment, Airbus's new CEO, Bernard Lattier, stumbles out of bed and answers the phone.
Who is this? It's 6:30 in the morning. I have an urgent message from the French ambassador to India. He says you must come to Delhi right away. If you don't, Airbus's deal with Indian Airlines is dead. The Americans are back in the game.
Lattier's heart sinks. When the French government put him in charge of Airbus, they gave clear instructions. Save Airbus or kill it. Now, every deal counts, even a three-plane deal with Indian Airlines. By noon, Lattier's in the air, heading to Delhi to save a deal Airbus thought it had in the bag. 2 days later, Lattier finally arrives at Indian Airlines headquarters for a one-to-one with its chairman, Air Chief Marshal Pratap Chandra Lal. Lattier doesn't know what Boeing's offering, but he reckons he's got something the Americans don't. The jowly Airbus boss sits and smiles at the former Indian Air Force commander.
I want to thank you for making me come to India to fight for this deal. You see, it's my birthday today. I'm 46. And if it wasn't for this contest, I would not have been able to celebrate my birthday in the country of my birth.
Lal's surprised, but Lattier's not lying. He was born in Calcutta. Suddenly, Lattier's eyes widen.
Ah, I must show you something.
Lattier reaches into his beige suit jacket for his wallet. He opens it up, removes a yellowing photograph, and hands it to Lal. Lal immediately recognizes the man in the photograph. It's Mahatma Gandhi, the leader of India's campaign for independence from Britain. Lattier moves around to Lal's side of the desk.
See the boy standing there next to Gandhi?
Yes.
That's me, aged 3 1/2.
That evening, Indian Airlines throws a dinner for the aircraft manufacturers vying for its business. Lattier finds himself surrounded by Americans. On the table to his left are the team from Lockheed. To his right, the 18-strong Boeing delegation. The Boeing crew look pleased with themselves. They think this deal is theirs. But then, after the main course, the lights go down. Two waiters enter the room carrying a large birthday cake topped with candles. They head to Lattier's table and start singing.
Happy birthday to you.
The Boeing team glare as Lal joins in.
Happy birthday, Monsieur Lattier. Happy birthday to you.
Cake in front of him, Lattier winks at the Boeing table and blows out the candle. Indian Airlines buys Airbus. But if Lattier wished for more orders, he's going to be disappointed. In 1976, Airbus sells exactly one A300. That's it. By 1977, the A300 looks like a dud. It's been on sale 5 years and gotten just 37 orders. Airbus seems like another European aviation failure that's burning through the taxpayers' money to make a plane no one wants. Even the true believers in the French government are asking themselves whether they should withdraw their support for the project. And while Airbus stalls, Boeing's flying high. The recession that sunk the American economy is over. With passenger numbers climbing, airlines are buying planes again. And they're mostly buying Boeing. The 747 is now making millions, and the company's medium-haul 737 is fast becoming the workhorse of the world's airlines. Boeing's U.S. rivals are struggling, too. Lockheed's under investigation for bribing foreign officials to win orders. McDonnell Douglas has been hit by a spate of DC-10 crashes. Boeing now owns half the market and is rapidly gaining altitude. But Lattier is not giving up. He thinks the A300 can be saved. But to do it, he needs a deal that will turn the heads of airline chiefs and make them take Airbus seriously. And only one deal can do that. A contract with a major U.S. carrier. It's time for Airbus to make a sortie into enemy airspace.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. It's December 1976, and in Miami, Airbus Chief Bernard Lottier's in Eastern Airlines headquarters. Eastern is one of America's biggest carriers, and Lottier's spent the past hour selling the A300 for all he's worth. Now, he's waiting to hear what Eastern CEO Frank Borman thinks. Borman's a former astronaut with close-cropped hair and a reputation for driving a hard bargain. He has to. Eastern's fleet is outdated, and it's nearly $1 billion in debt. Lottier reckons the competitively priced and fuel-efficient A300 is ideal for Eastern. Borman sits back in his chair and locks eyes with Lottier.
Well, the A300 is an impressive aircraft for sure. I like the low price. I love the fuel efficiency. But I'm not buying.
Lottier, stunned.
You like the Airbus, but don't want it? Why not? What's holding you back?
The problem is that no other airline in America flies Airbus. That means you don't have servicing and support on the ground in the U.S.
Lottier doesn't know what to say. This is a chicken and egg problem. Because Airbus hasn't sold any jets in the U.S., it doesn't have a support service. But without support, it can't sell its jets. But then, Lottier remembers an old trick from the car trade.
Tell you what, we'll give you 4 A300s, free of charge, for 6 months. After that, you either buy or give them back. Fly before you buy.
Now, Borman's lost for words. No aircraft manufacturers ever offered such a deal before. But Borman figures, if Lottier's this desperate, he must be able to squeeze even more out of him.
All right. But you pay for the maintenance and the pilot training.
We'll cover the maintenance, but we're not training your pilots for free.
Borman can live with that.
All right. I agree.
Over the next few months, the A300 quickly proves its value. It's not just reliable. It's fuel efficient and quiet, too. But Borman's still not ready to buy. He tells Airbus that Eastern's financial situation is so precarious, it can't afford the deal. So Airbus pulls together a sweetheart finance package built around low-cost loans and export credit from the French and West German governments. Airbus even agrees to pay the import tariffs Eastern will face for buying A300s.
In March 1978, Lattier returns to Miami, finance package in hand, expecting to seal the deal. But Borman's not done yet. After Lattier finishes walking him through the financing, he throws a curveball.
This financial package is great, but you know, I'm still unsure about this.
Lattier's face falls. He's jumped through hoops to make this deal as painless as possible for Eastern. The Airbus board almost sacked him for his fly-before-you-buy offer.
What is the problem now?
The A300's too large. We really need a 170-seater, not a 250-seater.
Lattier pauses. Airbus is already set to lose money on this deal, but he knows getting Eastern's business will give Airbus the credibility boost it needs. It's going to hurt, but it's time for another concession.
You're killing me. But okay, how about we only charge you as if it was a 170-seat plane? You see, if you use the extra capacity, then you pay in full.
Borman grins. Now, even if Eastern fails to fill its A300s with passengers, it can't lose. He extends his hand over the table.
Now that is an offer too good to refuse. You got yourself a deal.
In April 1978, Eastern orders 23 A300s with an option to buy another 25 in a deal worth more than $750 million. The deal shocks America's aircraft makers. Until now, Boeing, Lockheed, and McDonnell Douglas regarded Airbus as another European government vanity project destined for failure. Now, Airbus is invading their home turf. Even more alarming is the generous deal Eastern got. It looks like a giveaway, the kind of deal only a manufacturer backed by a bottomless pit of government money could offer. One McDonnell Douglas executive is so incensed, he calls Borman to vent.
What the hell, Frank? You flew the Apollo 8 mission. You're supposed to be an American hero, and here you are, buying European.
Borman slaps the McDonnell Douglas executive down.
Remind me, who makes the car you drive?
The McDonnell Douglas man goes quiet.
Yeah, thought so. I think we're done here.
Soon after, Eastern begins pushing its new European jets on TV with Borman as the face of the company.
The A300 is our biggest new investment. It's quiet, fuel-efficient, spacious. But if our crew doesn't make you feel comfortable, it won't matter what plane you're flying. I fly Eastern, but you don't have to. So we have to earn our wings every day.
The Eastern deal's a game-changer. Overnight, the doors of the world's airlines open up to Airbus. After years in the cold, Airbus is a contender. By 1979, the A300's lifetime sales passed the 300 mark. Boeing might sell that in a year, but there's no ignoring the fact that Airbus is now on the radar. And for Boeing, that means it's time to strike back. Hard. On the next episode, Boeing seeks help on Capitol Hill, transatlantic tensions rise, and Airbus reinvents flight. Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is Business Wars. A quick note about the conversations in this episode. We can't know exactly what was said, but this dialogue is based on our best research. I'm your host, David Brown. Tristan Donovan wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louis. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.